Our topic for tonight is the election of 1965, which was a brutal election. It was a very brutal election. For those who were here last week, we had a small crowd last week, so I'll fill in those who weren't here. In 1965, Israel experienced the consolidation of its two political flanks, the left and the right. That on the right side of the aisle, there had been the center and the right, which competed against each other for votes among those who were looking to vote for a non-socialist party. The right wing of Chirut of Menachem Begin represented those who were territorial maximalists and just hardline revisionist Zionists. And the general Zionist, which was then transformed into the Liberal Party, represented a moderate point of view on matters of war and peace, but laissez-faire capitalism against the socialist welfare state, and in favor of the private economy. So instead of beating each other up again in another election cycle, they decided to join forces to form Gachal Gush Chirut Liberalim, a coalition of Chirut and the Liberals, in order to have a viable alternative to another round of labor Zionist victories. It was the wise thing to do. It was something that was 15 years in the making, and even Ben-Gurion understood that it was likely to happen. But, as we'll see, there are problems with that alliance and will lead to a breakaway. On the other side of the aisle, you have the Mapai Party, which has never lost. In 30-some-odd years, it's been in charge of the Yishuv and in the state. But it has had trouble, including the removal of Ben-Gurion and his henchmen to form a separatist Rafi Party. But the Achdut HaAvodah, which was always the more ideologically pure faction of labor Zionism, was back in the fold. That there was once again Achdut, some measure of unity, on the left side of the aisle. So you have an alignment, Ma'arach, on the left, and you have Gachal on the right. And they're going to duke it out to see who's going to form the next government. Of course, we know who wins. The left side of the aisle wins. They don't lose it until 1977. But the idea here is that instead of having so many different factions compete against each other at the polls, you'll have a smaller number of parties because you have this consolidation of the various flanks. Now, the breakaways were that on the left side of the aisle, Ben-Gurion was kicked out of Mapai and took Shimon Peres and Moshe Dayan with him and established Rafi, Rishimat Pole Yisrael, as a non-sectoral, nominally centrist party that was formerly of the left wing, and it was very activist on matters of war and peace, wanted to take it to the enemy, and take it hard to the enemy, and favored nuclear weapons, as opposed to the Achdut HaAvodah and the rest of Mapai, which was lukewarm on nuclear weapons. And then on the right side of the aisle, the independent liberals broke away from Gachal, because they were very centrist in their orientation, and they could not fathom how their party was going to make common cause with a fascist like Menachem Begin. So they establish a centrist party that will go to the polls on not on matters of war and peace, but on domestic issues only. And we'll see what those domestic issues were. Okay, so let's now look at some of the advertisements and see how everyone is being scared into voting not for the other guy, but for the party that's doing the propaganda. This is the scariest ad we've seen so far. What is this? Okay. So, it's not numbers. No. It's not. Those are not tattooed arms out of Auschwitz. No, that's like out of the Addams Family or Frankenstein. It's just three hands grabbing at something. You don't see a body. You just see hands grabbing. And what is it grabbing? So it says, "Hama'arach mimcha yikach." The alignment will take from you the following things: Priya Malcha, the fruit of your labor; Zechuyotecha, your rights; Chirutecha, your freedom. And who says this? Gachal, Gush Chirut Liberalim. So in other words, if you want to live in a free society where the government is not going to boss you around and steal every dollar you earn in tax revenue, then you have to vote for us. You can't once again put the slip of paper into the ballot box in favor of a left-wing government. You got to vote something different this time around. So it's scaring the people not to vote for the alignment. Fear tactics.
But are they posing a platform, or they're just going...
I'm glad you asked. Now let's look at the platform. So that's the next page. The platform was no simple thing to produce, because remember, it's a coalition of two disparate parties that are now in an electoral list together. So they have to agree on some things, but obviously not on all things. And each side is going to have to give in a little bit in producing this platform. So just a few of the highlights. For example, Lo notzar ha'adam bishvil ha'medina. Man wasn't created to serve the state. Hamadina notzra bishvil ha'adam. The state was created to serve man. Now, that's sort of the opposite of what Kennedy had to say just a few years earlier in his inaugural. But this is a very important point from the standpoint of Israeli politics. Ben-Gurion's mamlachtiyut, his statism, and his chalutziyut, his pioneerism, always was predicated on the individual subordinating his or her needs or wants or wishes to that of the collective. Now, not the collective in like the evil sense of Soviet communism, but the collective needs of Klal Yisrael, Am Yisrael in its land, that you have to take one for the team if need be. Whereas Gachal is saying, no, the state is an instrument by which we can improve the lot of individuals. And that's a polar opposite approach. But keep in mind that the right side of the political aisle tends to think this way in every civilized country and not so civilized country, that the state exists not for its own purposes as an end unto itself. The state exists for the betterment of its people. And of course, people will have fair disagreements as to what are the best policies to pursue, but on the whole, the government exists to make sure that people's rights are protected, and everything, the society as a whole is improved, not so that you can be a slave to the state. This is an argument of sort of anti-Ben-Gurionism in its finest. Next point. Binyanach ha-chevra yushtat al chirut ha-prat v'tzedek chevrati. The society will be based upon, will be founded upon, chirut ha-prat, the freedom of the individual, v'tzedek chevrati, and social justice. Now, those two can sometimes be at odds with each other. The rights of the individual, or the legitimate wants and needs of the individual, can be in conflict with the broader aim of social welfare, of tzedek chavrati. So the platform here says, she'ein lahafrid b'nehem. We can't try to separate one from the other, meaning don't focus exclusively on tzedek chevrati at the expense of the prat of the individual. They have to be equally important and pursued simultaneously, which is again an assault on Marxism and even on social democracy, to be honest. Okay, the next point, and this may have been where chayrut caves in to the wishes of the liberals, she'ifa metamedet l'shalom im amei Arav. What does that mean? Ever-persistent pursuit of peace with the Arab world. Now, notice not the Palestinians, the Arab world. The Arab world. So, was Chayrut really in favor of that? I don't know. Maybe deep down in his heart, Menachem Begin was. And in 1978-79, he proved it by the Camp David Accords. But I'm sure this was not going to be a high point on the Chayrut agenda if it weren't for the fact they were in alignment with the liberals. Okay. The next point. Dichiyat kol lachatz lachzarat ha-pleitim Haravim l'shitcha shel Yisrael, rejecting all international pressure to return the Arab refugees to the land of Israel. Hapitaron ha'achid, the only solution l'bayatam to their problem is yishuvam medinot Arab. Let them be resettled in Arab countries. In other words, don't at all soften the position of the Israeli state vis-a-vis refugees from the 1948 war. Now, why is this so important? Because at various times, parties on the left side of the aisle did moderate their position. The Moshe Sharet Havlaga wing of the Mapai party had said, oh, we'll allow 100,000 Arabs back, or we'll allow this number of Arabs back. And Chayrut's position was, you allow zero Arabs back. Now, truth be told, Ben-Gurion was always pretty strong on this. And I would imagine Eshkol was too, as the successor. And it really wasn't even much of an issue in the mid-60s. But it's a nice hardline position you could take without getting yourself into trouble. Yeah.
The PLO was not founded in 64.
Right.
In 67, that the Khartoum Conference said no to...
Yeah, so we're going to address that at great length. But what I'm saying here is that the refugee issue was not really a focus of anybody's attention in the mid-60s. It kind of lost any steam by the mid-50s. And then Israel's just in a perpetual state of war with the Arab countries, and no one's talking about Palestinian refugees. All right, next one. Ein hityashnut kefi she'ein shechachav ha'para al pishayhem shel b'nei ha'am ha'germani tachat ha'mishtar ha'nazi klapei ha'am ha'yehudi. So in other words, no relationship with Germany, even though there's been the passage of time, our feelings are still as filled with anger in 1965 as they were in 1945. No softening of the position against Germany.
But wasn't the bond door already closed with the
yes.
Now leaving?
The matter was sort of a moot point because, number one, the Wiedergutmachung was already in effect. Diplomatic relations with West Germany was already in effect by early 1965.
They took the money, and
they're continuing to take the money at that point. Also, there's military relations between the IDF and the West German military. So, there's not much they can do to roll that back other than to say we're really angry about it, we're not happy about it, we would never have done such a thing. Okay? And...
those are empty words at this point.
Of course, but empty words can win you votes in an election cycle. Empty votes. This is an important one. Here's very important. Ha'itonot b'Yisrael tehei chofshit. The newspaper, the press, should be free. Lelo tzenzura mukdemet. Without prior restraint. Okay, so there could be censorship, maybe, when necessary for military purposes, but no prior restraint of publishing things. And this is critical because in the 1960s, including in the 1965 election cycle, there were newspaper publishers who were so incensed with the anti-defamation laws that were put out that they actually ran for parliament. And one of them was successful. We'll see where Yav Neri makes it into the Knesset. Okay, now, there was one thing I left out, where the Liberal Party had to cave in to the wishes of the Chairut agenda. And that was, and I don't have it printed here, okay, the entirety of Eretz Yisrael should be open to Jewish settlement, and the historic rights of Am Yisrael to Eretz Yisrael shall not be infringed. Now, bear in mind, in 1965, a Jew can't live in Gush Etzion because there is no Gush Etzion. It's across the border. So this is all theoretical. But even theoretical stuff matters to a fundamentalist party like the Chairut. We should have the rights to all of Eretz Yisrael, and if we would ever get a hold of it, we should have the right to live in any part of Eretz Yisrael.
They also believe that both sides are joined.
Well, they don't talk about that anymore.
Kept up on that until peace.
Anyway, maybe, but it's really not mentioned much. Okay.
They're not talking about Greater Israel. They're talking about living in the Galil, where there are a lot of Arabs.
No. They're talking about the West Bank, Gaza. Okay, and maybe even Transjordan, but probably not Transjordan. So this is all a pie in the sky dream. Absent an armed conflict, you're not going to have the right to do that. But my point here is that the Liberal Party was willing to go along with this in a platform, even though they might not have agreed with it, because it's not going to come to pass. So you're agreeing to something that you don't have to worry about. Except 2 years later, it does come to pass. All right. Now, those who broke away from the Liberal Party, the independent liberals, because they couldn't bear being in an alignment with the Chairut, they established this independent liberal party, HaLiberal Ma'atzmim, and they were around from about 1965 to the early to mid-80s. Never with tremendous success, but they ran a good ad. This says, Leman Atidam, for the sake of their future. Now, what the kids in this picture, what do they look like?
Wasps.
So one, the boy could pass for a Sephardic Jew, maybe even an Arab, but probably not. Let's assume it's a Sephardic Jew. And what about the girl?
It's a girl.
She looks German, right? She's blonde, okay? Doesn't look too Jewish. The point is, this party is appealing to which kind of Israeli?
Secular.
Yes, secular. Yes, definitely secular. But what ethnic background? Ashkenazi. And what type of Ashkenazi?
European.
What type of European? Western and Central European. The people who made Aliyah in the 30s from Hamburg and Berlin and Dusseldorf, not from Vilna and Krakow and Lemberg. All right, so now why? Because this party is all about the rule of law. The rule of law, that Israel should be a Western democracy, not a party with the Protexia and Leninism and the worst vestiges of the Soviet bloc. No, this is going to be a free democratic society for the kinds of people who know about free democratic societies. Okay? Now, their other ad, and I mentioned because I said they focused on domestic issues. What does this look like? It's an ambulance. It's a Magen David Adom ambulance. And those are not soldiers carrying rifles. Those are medics carrying stretchers. Okay? And it says, okay, Bituach Briut Mamlachti, universal health care. Obamacare, okay? So, what other party was running in Israel in the first 17 years of its existence on a platform of universal health care? Now, yes, of course, the far-left parties all believed in that, but this is not a far-left party. This is a centrist party that believes in a capitalist economy, but they do believe in a first-class social welfare system for those purposes that are legitimate, namely health care. And what is their agenda here? Yagdil et misparamu amavutachim, will increase the number of people with insurance. You know, open enrollment will enroll a lot of people. Yaktina tatashtum ba'aripui, we're going to reduce the copays. Yevatel kfeilot b'shirutei arufuah, we're going to reduce the bureaucracy and redundancy in the healthcare system. And yisapek rofim b'yishuvei sfar, we'll make sure there are enough doctors and hospitals in the border regions of the country, which was a big problem in the early years of the state. I mean, if you lived far away from the major cities, you had bupkis. There was nothing there. You got sick, you died. So this, it's still a problem, yeah.
There was no kupat chulim?
No, there was, but the Histad route ran the better insurance systems. And one of the big issues in the Mapai was whether or not to extract the Kupat Cholim from the Histadrut and make it a state institution. That was the Rafi party's, well, before it was Rafi, it was Moshe Dayan and the Begurian sector of the Mapai. They believed in doing that at the expense of the Histadrut in favor of the state, because they believed in Mamlachtiyut, that the state should control all the important institutions and not a trade union. As much as they loved the trade union in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and 50s, it was time for the state to take over essential services. Okay.
Today, anyone could join Kupat Cholim.
I don't think you could, no.
It depended who you worked for.
Yeah, it was
right.
So, yeah. Okay. So that takes care of the right side of the aisle in the center. Now let's go to the left side of the aisle. The Ma'arach, the alignment, which is Mapai Nachdut Avoda, is confident that they're going to win. They've always won. They're going to win again. And what is their initials? Aleph and Taf. The Aleph was the Mapai. The Taf was the Achdut Avoda. So put it together, Aleph, Taf. Okay. Later, when they joined with Mapam in 1969, it'll be Aleph Mem Taf, Emet. Toratenu Akdosha. Okay. So, this is a very plain ad. They don't need to do much advertising. They have every intention of winning and winning big and trouncing the opposition. So, Rafi. Rafi is relying upon the strength of one man's reputation and one man only, David Ben-Gurion. You put his picture on the ad, and you hope for the best. You roll the dice with one man's reputation, the old man, the Zaken, the Saba of Israel. All right. What is Rafi's political platform? They have a whole song and dance. It doesn't matter. Nobody even read it. The main thing is this: three lines. Three lines right here. Ba'alei ha-malacha, ha-socharim ha-ze'irim va'atzmaim, lo yifnu l'marachim yiminim, shel ba'alei hon gadol. Basically, the small-time shopkeeper, manufacturer, businessman, who's not a heavyweight of industry, not a titan of industry, such people are not going to vote for the far-right parties. Or at least, Rafi says they shouldn't. Why? Because those parties are for the big man. Shel ba'alei hon gadol. They're for the guys who own the hotels on the beach in Tel Aviv, and for the guys who own multi-million dollar factories. The right wing is for the rich. Okay? So, you're not going to vote for them. But you're also not going to vote for the left. Why? Because what is really controlling the alignment, the left-wing alignment now? Not a reasonably centrist Mapai, but a rapidly left-wing Achdut Avoda. Was that a fair criticism of the alignment? It was. The Mapai had lost control of the alignment. Achdut Avoda really was wielding a tremendous degree of authority, as we'll see in the allotment of ministries and so on. And so Rafi's point is, if you're a centrist and you don't want to vote for the rich fat cats, and you don't want to vote for the uber left-wing socialists, what's your choice? Your choice is us. Vote for us. And plus we have Ben-Gurion, and he's the granddaddy of Israel. So they're heavy hitters. Their leaders were Yisrael Galili and Yigal Alon. Yes, yeah, but they
Galili
was a major factor, and so was Galili behind the scenes. Yeah.
Was there any inkling or discussion of a potential war down the road?
Okay, that brings us to the next ad. Rafi ran one more ad. One more ad. And what does this look like?
Adam.
It looks like a reference to nuclear weapons. Okay. So it's supposed to be a reference to that without saying so explicitly. Remember, Israel will not be the first one to introduce nuclear weapons into the Middle East. So it has to be only a veiled reference. So this says, Tukufa Chadasha, a new era. Yozma Chadasha, new courage. Machshavot Chadashot, new ideas. Anashim Chadashim, new people. That's a bluff if I ever saw one. There's nothing new about David Ben-Gurion and Moshe Dayan and Shimon Peres. Yes, there were other people down lower on the list who were new to the Knesset when they would win 10 seats. But this is bogus, if there ever was one. This is just saying, if you believe in a nuclear Israel, a strong, powerful nuclear Israel, this is your party, Rafi.
Did they have a nuclear weapon at that time?
It was in the development. And when it actually was serviceable remains a big question that we can't fully answer because it wasn't tested. Or at least, well, we'll talk about whether it was tested.
Right.
Yeah.
In this discussion, there seems to be no influence of the American settlers. They would come after the Six-Day War.
Americans are a non-factor until after the Six-Day War, yeah. Okay, so actually, now that you mentioned nuclear weapons, let's just discuss that for a second. What was the fate of the nuclear project on Israeli politics? So I referenced it a week or two ago that in 1961 there was tremendous pressure by the Kennedy administration on Ben-Gurion to reveal what was going on in Dimona. So one of the reasons why Ben-Gurion resigned in 61 and tried to form a new coalition was just to buy time. That during a transitional phase in a developing country, a powerful, you know, superpower cannot expect compliance with their demands. Like, you respect the sovereignty of the little guy, that they get their act together, they put their government in order, and then you'll pressure them the next cabinet cycle about inspections of a nuclear facility. So Ben-Gurion purposely resigned and dragged out the 1961 elections and dragged out the coalition talks to kill almost a whole year, which was a critical year in the development of Dimona. Then, in 1963, when the pressure was again intense, what did he do? He resigned, and for good, knowing that Eshkol would take time to develop a cabinet, and again, you buy more time until Dimona is finished. And by that point, it basically was ready to go into service. So a lot of the shenanigans of the electoral cycle was really just to keep the Americans off the backs of the Israelis. Then, by 1966, there are those who say that there was a serviceable weapon. The problem is there was no delivery mechanism, which means that it isn't all that useful unless you were to drop it from an airplane or to drive it into the desert in Sinai and detonate it remotely from some close enough distance. Did Israel ever test a bomb? So Yesh Omrim, that there were three events of testing. In 1963, there was a zero yield, and I don't know what that even means. My father would know better than me. A zero yield test. So I don't know what that means, but some kind of a test. In 1966, there may have been a test in the Negev below ground of an actual weapon. And in 1979, in the Indian Ocean, there may have been a test known as the Vela incident, together with collaboration with South Africa. So for those who were here when I discussed Mordechai Vanunu, I discussed that incident, the Vela incident of 79, at some length. The Carter administration was convinced that it really was a nuclear test, and Israel and South Africa had collaborated. All right, but suffice it to say, in the mid-60s, there are those who know that something is in the works, and there are those who play like they don't know, and there are some people who really don't know. But in the political class, everybody has at least an inkling of what's being developed in the Negev. Okay. Now let's go to the left side of the aisle. And 1965 is a fun election cycle because the left, the far, far left, had a lot of parties competing against each other. some of them with very interesting backstories. So the least interesting is Mapam. Mapam had been around since 1948, and their spiel was the same every time. Secularism versus religion, decent relations with the Soviet bloc, social democracy, and criticism of Mapai's handling of matters of defense and security. So, the following. Tenu l'chiot b'Shabbat. Let us live on Shabbos. Let us live on Shabbos. Now, what does it mean, l'chiot? It doesn't mean to make Kiddush and Havdalah. So, Rov Ezrachei HaMedina Hem Anashim Chiloniim. Most of the public are secular people. Ein l'chpot aleihem et chok HaShabbat. You can't impose upon them the law of the Sabbath. Now, when we say Chok HaShabbat, we don't mean Torah law. We mean the state of Israel had a bill before the parliament called Chok HaShabbat, which was going to severely restrict public activities on Saturday. So, Gamim Ben Gurion Eshkol V'Galili Hitchayvu Alav Beheskem HaKoalitzia in 1961. Hatzibur Yedchei Oto. Even though Ben Gurion Eshkol V'Galili had agreed in the coalition talks in 61 to capitulate to the demands of the Maftal, of the National Religious Party, the public at large does not want it. So yes, coalition politics demanded it, but we, the general public, say no, boo-hoo to you. Now, Chok Zeh, this law, Yafsik et ha-tachbura tziborit, b'yom ha-shishi achar ha-tzoharayim motzei Shabbat, it's going to cause a shutdown of basically all public services on Friday afternoon and Saturday night. Hu yizgol lefanecha b'Shabbat kol kiosk v'chol tachanat delek. All the little kiosks, the shops, the bodegas, and the tachanat delek, the gas stations, are going to be shut. Hu yimna kol bidur tarbuti, also entertainment, cultural entertainment is going to be shut down. Then they say, as a matter of principle, kfiya eina marbe kavod ladat, coercion does not bring honor to religion. Kfiya ma'oreret itnagdut, coercion leads to opposition to religion, and vocal opposition. Teda memshala, hamli kabel chukei kfiya, Chok HaShabbat lo yakum. This will not stand. Tenu l'chiyot b'Shabbat. Let us live and enjoy life on the Sabbath. Then if they conclude, kol echad al pi darko hakarato umatzpuno. Everyone according to their own wishes and their own ideals. Their own conscience. Okay. So that is the Mapam fighting the battle against religious coercion. It's interesting, they put out a platform. I mean, every party put out a platform, but the Mapam had a very strong one in 1965. And I'll just give you the headlines. I don't have to go into the details. The headlines themselves say it all. Tinaten chukat yesod l'medina. We're going to fight for a constitution. Now, in 1948-49, many people wanted a constitution. But after it failed to pass, and the basic laws became the alternative to the constitution, nobody was really talking about this anymore. It was like a dead issue. Well, who's bringing it back? Mapam. Why? Because they're not... So, they were dissatisfied with the Mapai's handling of affairs of state, and they were not happy with, number one, capitulating to the religious parties, number two, subjugation of the Arabs, and number three, the monopoly that Mapai wielded over matters of defense, which will then play itself out in the next issues of the platform. Takum Moatza Lehagana Leumit, which means we shall establish a committee for national defense. That sounds like it comes right out of the Yishuv period, in the days of the Haganah High Command, when it was a voluntaristic thing, and there's a group of people who run the show. But after the state was established, who runs the military affairs? The Minister of Defense. The Minister of Defense and the Chief of Staff of the Army puts it into practice. So what the Mapam is saying is, we don't want that anymore. We want to open up the authority over matters of war and peace and national defense to a wider array of people. If you recall, in 1948, the Mapam did have a say over the military, Yisrael Galili. And what happened to him? Ben-Gurion fired him. And that led to a general's revolt. That was the first lecture we had for this whole series. It was on the general's revolt. Because the Mapam... Correct. Yes, exactly. So the Mapam is now, 17 years later, fighting an old battle, saying we don't want to be removed from decision-making on these grave issues. All right. Then, L'shivyon ma'amada shel ha'ishab medina, equal rights for women. All right, that's a good thing, you know, and other parties made the same claim, but they really meant it. The next one is Yuvtach Shivyon L'Chlusya Haravit, guaranteeing equal rights for the Arab population. Now, what's the issue with the Arab population? They're under military rule. They've been under military rule since the beginning of the state, since 1948. That will come to an end shortly in 1966, as we'll discuss tonight. But in 1965, as the election was happening, it was not a foregone conclusion that the military administration of the Arabs would end. The Mapai was running on a platform of, let's keep it going. The Achdut Avoda wanted to put it out of business. So that was an internal dispute in the alignment. But the Mapam says, we have to get rid of a military administration of the Arabs. They're equal citizens of Israel. Treat them as such. Okay. So now we go to the other far-left parties. And the good old standard is Maki. All right. Maki, Miflegat Kommunist Yisraeli, the Communist Party of Israel. And what's their appeal? Well, they have an Arab kid playing with a Jewish girl, an Arab boy and a Jewish girl playing jacks, playing dice together on the street corner. All right? And there's pictures of doves, you know, so peace, love. Well, they are known for being dishonest in their political sloganeering. So it says like this: Mediniyot Chutz Yisraelit Atzmait. We want to have an independent Israeli foreign policy. Now that's a joke, because their foreign policy would be tied to the Comintern, to whatever the Politburo has to say. So this is one big lie. I mean, the most egregious lie of the whole political cycle is that the Maki wants to have an independent foreign policy. HaTomechet b'chol yozma l'shmirat ha'shalom ha'olami v'ha'ezori, promoting world peace and regional peace. HaTomechet b'mavak kamim l'shichrur me'al ha'kolonizm v'neo-kolonialism. We want to help people free themselves from the scourge of colonialism and neo-colonialism. Of course, that's a code word for we hate Zionism. And ve'enam mizdahit im shum gush olami neged mishnayu. And we don't favor any side against the other in the Cold War. Now, what kind of garbage is that? We don't favor one side against the other in the Cold War. This is, of course, favoring the Soviet bloc. All right, but that's what happens. One lie after another. Then, hafsakat hityadidut im shalitei Bonn han neo-Nazim. No more relations with Bonn. The West German government, they refer to as neo-Nazis. Now, that's not really nice. I mean, the Bonn government was not a bunch of neo-Nazis, not in the mid-60s. But, all right, if you're a communist party, you're going to say that. Then, shipur yachasim brit ha-moatzot, improve relations with the Soviet Union. The irony, of course, is relations with the Soviet Union will collapse in this election cycle as a result of the Six-Day War. The last hurrah will be Yigal Alon's trip to Moscow 2 weeks before the war breaks out. And then, it's curtains, no more relations. Okay, then, good. We have to improve relations with the Arab world and recognize the legitimate rights of the Arabs. Hakara hadadit b'zchiyot hachukiyot shel shnei amim. And then, bitul ha'achlata shel hamemshala shelot nehel masamatan b'shlot ha'pelitim ayesod ha'achlata ta'um. We want to get rid of the government's decision not to negotiate over the return of Palestinian refugees as demanded by UN Resolution 194. In other words, the wall-to-wall consensus among the Zionist parties that there's no Arab right of return, the Communist Party says, oh yes, there is an Arab right of return, and we're going to force it down everybody's throat.
Are okay. The Russians stripping them money? Is that what?
Yes, of course. Right. However, they will stop after this cycle. Why? Because there'll be a breakaway, a different Communist Party, that I'll talk about in about 5 minutes when we discuss the electoral results. Okay.
So they essentially sold out.
Yeah, but there are also people who really believe all this stuff. It's not always about being a sellout for cash or for some personal gain. There are people, Jews in Israel, who are ideologically that far over. Now, the last thing...
Weren't the Russians just a casual number here in this country?
It's true, yeah.
Weren't the Russians still stuffing money to Egypt at this time?
Yes, very much so.
And in addition to that, you had the Soviet Jewry question, even at this time...
So the Soviet Jewry question is a non-factor in Israel until Golda Meir makes it a factor in 1969. It's a factor in America before it is in Israel. Okay, so the last thing is we want a nuclear-free zone in the Middle East. Of course, it's easy to say that for the communists because Israel's the only one who has any development in this front. So it's an inherently anti-Israel position. Yeah?
You said many times that the Arab groups were either the front for the labor.
Yes.
And When do they start coming into their own?
Okay, good, good, good. In 1965. And that relates to your question also. We're going to discuss it. Raqqa. Rishimat Komunisti Dacharasha. So, before we get to them, two more Jewish parties. So one is Uri Avneri's Ha'olam Hazeh. Ha'olam Hazeh was a publication, like a tabloid, like the New York Post or the National Enquirer, but not the Enquirer. It was more like the Post. And Avneri was, if you recall his biography, he was a member of the Irgun in the 40s, and then had a metamorphosis. By the 1960s, he's very pro-Palestinian. And by the 1980s, he's meeting Yasser Arafat illegally. He died this year, a few months ago, I think. So his party, Ha'olam Hazeh, was also known as Meri. What is Meri in Hebrew?
Rebellion.
So it's an acronym for Miflaga, or Merkaz Radikali Yisraeli, the Israel Radical Party. And his slogan was Shichrur Michukei Kfiya. We want a freedom from religious coercion. Shivyon Bili Hevdel Eidal Laom. Equality regardless of your national origins or your ethnic origins. And Shalom Yisrael Arab. Peace between Arabs and Israelis. So Shin Shin Shin. The letter for the slip in the box was a Shin for Shichrur, Shivyon, and Shalom. That's Avneri's party. You'll see he wins one seat. But the last one is even more interesting. Abi Natan. Does that name ring a bell to any of you?
Yes.
Abi Natan. Okay. So Abi Natan was like the Rudolf Hess of Israel. Okay, yes.
Oh, yeah.
He was a Persian Jew, and he made Aliyah in 1948 to serve in Machal as a volunteer from overseas, and he stayed in the country, and his opinion was, you have to do more to make peace with the Arabs. In February of 66, after this election cycle, in which he does not win a seat in the Knesset, he only wins 2,000 votes, he flies a plane to Egypt and tries to meet with Nasser. He's arrested and deported. And then he's arrested again when he gets back to Israel for having gone to Egypt illegally. Then he meets with Arafat in the 80s. He establishes the Ship of Peace, which was a broadcast illegally off the waters. It's like the counterpart to Arutz Sheva, you know, the opposite of Arutz Sheva. So he was wealthy enough to fund all this stuff. In 1993, he ran into some economic trouble, and he shut down the Ship of Peace, basically because he ran out of money, but also because he said the Oslo Accords made this an irrelevant point. Now we reached the stage where my opinion is now the publicly accepted opinion. So his party's letters were Nun Samach Nes. So Hatovim LaKnesset with the play on the letters. So Abi Natan Hatayas Halochem. He was a fighter pilot in the 48 war. Hamucham Lilchom Lemana Shalom. Now he's going to fight for peace. Okay, and the party was named after him, Rishimat Abi Natan LeKnesset. So usually there's some nice name for it. No, it was the Abi Natan Party. Okay.
Was he ever elected to the Knesset?
No, never.
Is he still around?
No, he died 10 years ago, 2008. Okay, so now I brought some stuff from the religious parties, but they were kind of boring this cycle. The only thing is the National Religious Party had Rav Moshe Tzvi Neria as their go-to guy in the ad, and for the Aguda, the Aguda was quoting the Belzer Rebbe, Rav David Sperber, the Chazon Ish, the Brisker Rav, Rav Aaron Cutler, and a few others. Now most of those had already died by 1965, so they're quoting those who were Zichronam Livracha, not Shlita. There were other Gedolim who were still alive who could have offered endorsements, but the heavyweights of Rabbinic Judaism for the most part died in the 1950s, so you quote them and it remains valid for the next election cycle. Okay.
Exactly.
Like the rabbi who gives a hechsher on Seltzer years after he died. Alright, so now what actually happened? Let's find out. So 1.5 million Israelis were eligible to vote. 1.25 million actually voted.
Wow.
83% turnout, which is average turnout. It's a pretty good turnout, but it's an average one for Israel. The alignment won 45 seats. Now, that is a disappointment from their point of view, because they had 50. They had 50 if you combine Mapai and Achdut Avodah from the previous cycle. They went down 5. But 45 is still way ahead of anybody else, so they win. Gachal won 26, which was a disappointment because they had 17 plus 17 the previous cycle. That's 34. They went down 8 together. So both the left alignment and the right alignment did better apart than they did together. All right. The National Religious Party won 11 seats. They went down 1. Rafi was brand new. They won 10. And the polls predicted they would win 10, despite Ben-Gurion saying we're going to win an outright majority. He wasn't lucid at that point. All right. Mapam won 8. They went down 1. The Independent Liberals were new. They won 5. Aguda won 4. They broke even. The Poale Aguda won 2. They broke even. The Arab satellite parties of Mapai won 2 plus 2 is 4. They broke even. Ha'olam Hazeh Avneri was brand new. He won 1 seat. And Maki won 1 seat. They went down 4. They had 5 previously. They only got 1. And Abi Natan didn't make it into the parliament. But I left out one party, Raqqa. What is Raqqa? So Raqqa was Rishimat Kommunistat Haradasha. It was a brand new communist party. It was a breakaway from Maki. Now what happened? Arabs and Jews were getting along in the communist party since the 1920s. And since the establishment of the state in 1948, it was a joint Arab-Jewish party. But do Arabs and Jews really get along? No. So, for that reason, the Arabs wanted to have their own communist party to break away from Moshe Sneh and Shmuel Mikunis of Maki and have their own go at it. So they did. But they preserved the pretense of it being not an exclusively Arab party. They kept one Jewish member. Who? Mayor Vilner. Mayor Vilner, the biggest sellout of them all. Okay? He would be one of the longest serving members of Knesset. 41 years he was in Knesset. From 1949 to 1990, he would finally, you know, disappear from the scene. But Raqqa was identified by the Soviet Union as the legitimate communist party of the State of Israel. And Maki, because Arab, and Maki was seen as a bourgeois sellout. Now, was Maki a bourgeois sellout? No, they were a flagrantly communist party with pro-Soviet opinions. But from the Soviet point of view, who are the real communists? The Arabs, not the Jews. Bunch of anti-Semites. Okay, so now what happens? The coalition is established, and the government comes into play in January of 66, 2 months after the election. The coalition has 75 members. The alignment had 45. The National Religious Party had 11. Mapam, 8. Independent Liberals, 5. The Arabs, 4. And Poale Aguda, 2. So that's a total of 75.
How much did Raqqa get?
Raqqa got 3. And Maki got 1, so it's 4. Okay. Now what happened was, in this election cycle, the National Religious Party did very well for itself. Although it only won 11 seats and had 12 previously, they were very well positioned. Because Mapai, or the alignment, refused to go into a cabinet with Gachal or
the communists
or Mapam. Without Gachal, without the communists. So what happened was that
there's nobody left.
Right. The only way it's going to work, without Rafi.
Oh, yeah,
so Rafi is 10, Gachal is 26, that's 36. That's a pretty big chunk. All the other parties are very small. So the National Religious Party is the deal breaker. You need them or it isn't going to work. Now, this becomes a very important thing in 1967. Because in 1967, Shapira and the others in the National Religious Party will say, we want a national unity government. You have to have a national unity government, Eshkol, which means bring in Menachem Begin and bring in Rafi, Moshe Dayan. And Eshkol couldn't resist that pressure because Mafdal and RP could collapse the whole thing if they wanted to. So they were able to wield the kind of authority that they never had before just because of the quirk of how the election worked out.
Wasn't the National Religious Party always a bridge, a deal maker?
They were always reliably in the coalition with Mapai and typically did not cause a lot of trouble on issues other than religion and state, like who was a Jew, the Shabbos law, the like, but not weighty issues like national unity government and war and peace that they had never done before.
Is this the start where they start making?
Yes. Okay, so who's in the government? Well, Eshkol is the prime minister, Eshkol is the defense minister, as, you know, Kimin Hago. Mapam gets a few ministries, not too many important ones. The National Religious Party gets a lot. Okay, they get the Ministry of Religions, they get the Ministry of Welfare, they get the Internal Affairs. They do very well for themselves. The Pauli Aguda gets one deputy ministry. Kalman Kahana is deputy minister of education. But the alignment holds for themselves most of the major portfolios.
Mintz
was not around for this one. Postal minister was previously. Yeah. So the big change was in foreign ministry. Who had been the foreign minister up until now? Golda. And who will follow her? Abba Ibn. Why did this happen? So Golda retired. Golda retired because, at the surface level, she claimed, I'm old and I'm sick. She had lymphoma. Now, she would recover and do, you know, live another 13 years, and including 5 years as the prime minister. But there's another reason. Golda's career was basically at a dead end. She had served as foreign minister for 10 years, 56 to 66, and she had no chance of ever becoming prime minister because she's an old woman. And we don't make old women the prime minister of a country. So therefore, since she has nowhere to go, she retires. She didn't give up her Knesset seat, because she'll go to Yerushalayim, you know, a few days a week and sit in the parliament as a backbencher. But she's retired, finished. The party didn't like that, and the truth is, a month after retiring, so called, she got sick of retirement and decided she wanted back in. So she became the secretary general of the Mapai, and then later, she becomes Secretary General in 1968 of the Labour Party, after the alignment becomes the Labour Party. So she becomes a great power broker and a kingmaker, ultimately crowning herself the king. But for reasons we'll get to in a few weeks, in 1969. So that's the one major change. Now, Eban had been waiting in the wings for this job since he was in diapers. At the age of 33... he was already the ambassador at the UN, representing the Jewish agency before the establishment of the state. He was the face of Israeli diplomacy for a very, very long time.
He's still in New York,
right? He still lives in the Upper West Side, even from the Kever. So, he died in 2002, actually. And when he died, and I mentioned this, we had a whole lesson about him. When he died, everyone went to his funeral, and Rav Lau said we didn't appreciate him enough when he was alive. That we all made fun of him when he was alive, but the truth is he was a great man, and we did him a disservice in his lifetime.
When he was UN ambassador, he was also concurrently...
ambassador in Washington, correct. Yes, correct. Okay, so he wanted the job, he got the job. Now, what happens after this government is established? So, 1966 is a year in which the opposition, led by Gachal and assisted by Rafi, are savagely attacking Eshkol for incompetence. Now, last week I had mentioned that Ben-Gurion had listed like a whole roster of Ashamnu, Bagadnu, Gazalnu that Eshkol was guilty of. But it continues into the next administration, to the next cabinet. And most of it had to do with matters of national defense. The most important mistake was the Battle of Samu. The Battle of Samu was on November 13th, 1966. What happened was, there had been terrorist infiltrations all throughout the course of the year. And more often than not, they were coming from Syria, not from Jordan. But there was an incident where a roadside explosive went off, three Israeli soldiers were killed, a bunch more were injured. And it happened in the southern West Bank, not too far from Hebron, on the border of the West Bank. And so the assumption was that the infiltrators had come from there, and now was the time to make the Jordanians suffer a heavy price. And so 400 soldiers, with 50 vehicles, descended upon the village of Samu, blew up a lot of buildings, blew up a police station, they accidentally killed some civilians. It was not a good thing. One Israeli soldier died, and I think 17 or 18 Arabs died in the process. And everybody was livid. The United States was angry, the UN General Assembly was angry, the Security Council was angry that the provocation did not justify this kind of heavy-handed response. Now, in Israel itself, they don't worry so much about whether that was justified. What was the political calculus here? So the political calculus was, among the opposition parties, that it's a mistake to move heavily against the Jordanians, because after all, there was a tacit agreement with King Hussein not to have heavy raids against the West Bank, because if you do that, King Hussein is then forced to respond and join an Arab coalition in war against Israel. That so long as Hussein doesn't have to confront the Israelis, he won't. But if you force him to, he will. And that creates another front in a potential future conflict, another round, which is exactly the Six-Day War. The Six-Day War could have been and should have been just a war against Egypt. It became a war on all three fronts because, as we'll see in a few weeks or 2 weeks from now, the war was extended to Syria by Israeli decision, and the war was extended to Jordan by Jordanian decision. But the Jordanian decision was coerced upon them by the fact that Israel had been aggressive in the 7 or 8 months leading up to the war in terms of cross-border raids. So it's one of these things where, yes, you have to suffer your casualties and bite your lip and just let it go, because responding makes it even worse. So that was the criticism of Rafi, and not really Gachal, but Rafi, against Eshkol's regime, that they made a terrible blunder in escalating against the Jordanians.
Who was the spokesperson? Was it Dayan, or was it...
Ben-Gurion himself. Ben-Gurion himself, yes. Okay, now...
Wait a second, but wasn't Ben-Gurion and the Rafi people more military aggressive?
Interesting. So they were, but not in the year leading up to the Six-Day War. For whatever reason, Ben-Gurion became not a dove. He was still a hawk, but not a hawk who wanted to go to war now. Why? So next week, we'll talk at length about why during the waiting period, the Hamtana, Ben-Gurion opposed preemptive strikes. He had a theory of preemptive strike in 56, which he went for it, and an opposition to preemptive strike in 67, and was very much dismayed when it happened. Of course, he'd be proven wrong, because the war was a fabulous success, which led to his demise politically, because everyone realized he doesn't know what he's talking about anymore. He used to be the wise old man, now he's the guy who got it wrong. But he was a hawk who opposed war at that juncture. Yeah?
The United Arab Republic was also there, wasn't it?
So the United Arab Republic didn't exist anymore, officially. It existed from 58 to 61, and then disappeared formally, but was still relevant insofar as the Syrians and the Egyptians would coordinate their military affairs.
Wasn't Yemen part of that?
So Yemen was the Vietnam of Egypt. Yeah. It was their problem. It was like the Soviet Afghanistan. But that theory played into those who believed that war wouldn't happen because Egypt wasn't interested in fighting. That proved to be... I wouldn't say it's false, because remember, Egypt didn't start the war. Had Israel not fired the first shot, who's to say what would have happened? It's in the subjunctive, because it didn't work out that way. That's a casus belli, but it's not really war.
It's an act of war.
It's an act of war, but it's only an act.
Help me with that.
Okay, it means that Egypt didn't necessarily believe Israel would then respond by conquering the whole Sinai Peninsula in a real armed conflict. They may have thought they could get away with it and there not be a war.
Can close the Straits of Tehran and think it's not...
Nasser was not a Nobel Prize winner in game theory. He did something and not necessarily realizing what the inevitable consequences would be. Okay? So...
I had Rabbi Rachman as our professor. And he was one of the heads of the Sukkot.
Yeah.
And he was keeping us up to date up until the start of the war when he disappeared for a week. He came back when the war was over. I'm sure he wasn't hiding from the draft room. He was one of the leaders. And he told us that Nasser was pulling a stick up of the World Bank.
Uh-huh.
He wanted
money.
Big money.
Money, yeah, yeah.
Big money. And it just wasn't forthcoming, and things rolled.
Rolled out of it snowballed out of his control, really.
It went way out of his control.
Now, that's just a few more minutes we have left. The military situation was getting more intense. On April 7th of 67, there was a major dogfight in the air over Syria, over the Golan, between the Israel Air Force and the Syrian Air Force, which Israel did very well for itself and downed a bunch of Soviet-made jets. So things are getting very intense, and the Soviet Union is issuing propaganda that Israel has hostile intentions against Syria in order to rile up the Egyptians to get them to do something. Now, all this is in the realm of foreign affairs and leading up to war. But domestically, one very important thing happened in 66, and that is the end of the military administration over the Arabs. In November of 66, November 8th in particular, it comes to an official end. Why did this happen? Well, because arguably it was unjustified from the beginning, from a moral point of view. And even if it was justified from a practical point of view, at least in the beginning, By 1966, Israel was well established enough that it could afford to relax its iron, you know, vice grip over the Arab population of the Galilee and the Negev. It was probably in the ballpark of 10 to 12%, which is a lot less than it is today.
20%.
Now it's something like 20%. Yeah. So this is a major change because it has to do with legitimate Arab political participation. You mentioned about the satellite parties that were really the patsies of Mapai. There were two such parties, Shituf Avodah and Brotherhood and Peace. Each won 2 seats, so a total of 4. That's 4 votes in the Mapai pocket. But do the Arabs really want to be, the Arab citizens of Israel really want to be in the Mapai's pocket? No, they'd rather have an independent voice. But so long as the military administration controlled their lives and the Mapai was the government, it was nearly impossible for them to have true, free discussion and lists that represent their real feelings. The last time there'll be a Mapai satellite list will be 1973. They'll win 2 or 3 seats. So it eventually fizzles out within the decade after this event of 66. But the Raqqa is a legitimately Arab party. Communist, for sure, but Arabs can express their true feelings in an anti-Zionist sort of way. So going forward, that's going to be the main focus of Arab participation in Knesset affairs, to be not loyal members of the government, of the coalition, getting scraps, not even a ministry, but rather the vocal opposition, and a very vocal opposition at that. I mean, today, the joint list by Ayman Oda is a very vocal opposition. Ahmed Tibi, for all of his fun and games of correcting the Hebrew of the Jews, which he does very well, he's not really pro-Jewish state. So he could say that openly, whereas 50 years ago that was under wraps. Okay, so yeah, you had a question, Tina.
I just wonder if Eshkol had a reputation of being a Nebuchadnezzar when it came to defense.
Okay,
this
so
gave him a chance to.
Well, Eshkol didn't want to go to war. And as we'll discuss next time, he did everything he could to avoid going to war. His last best hope was that President Lyndon Johnson would supply a flotilla of international ships to go through the Straits of Tehran and break the blockade and reach Eilat, and that would restore the old status quo that had existed in the days when the United Nations force was the buffer zone. That didn't work out. Now, why it didn't work out, you could argue, well, there wasn't enough time or there wasn't enough resources. Rubbish. It didn't work out because Johnson really just wasn't going to do it. He wasn't going to get heavily involved. And whatever was going to happen in the Middle East was going to happen, hopefully without damaging American interests, but they weren't going to play an active role that Israel may have wanted them to play. Eshkol, his reputation as being a nebbish is because of his radio address that we'll talk about next time, where he fumfered a little bit too much, and that cost him the defense ministry, and it will go to Moshe Dayan. But in order for it to go to Moshe Dayan, you'd have to have a rapprochement between Rafi and the alignment, which isn't such a simple thing because the bad blood was very, very bad and very, very thick. Okay, and the rhetoric was vicious all throughout 1965, 1966, and early 1967. So the idea that someone from the outside is going to come in and take over the defense ministry didn't sit well with Eshkol himself or some others within the existing cabinet. But, as I said, the National Religious Party is in a very powerful position as a kingmaker, and they will insist upon it. Was it a smart move? Did it matter at all? I think in the long run it didn't matter much at all, because war plans were in place, and reshuffling the deck at the top 2 seconds before you fire the weapons doesn't really change the plans on the ground. So a lot of the glory, the kavod, goes to the wrong people. Everybody wants the kavod. And we're going to see, when we discuss the war, how the pictures, the photographs of who comes into the old city as a conquering hero will be a big problem, because it's going to be Narkis, Rabin, and Dayan, not Levi Eshkol. So Eshkol is going to show up 2 hours later when the bullets are still flying, and the Shin Bet says, "Don't go, it's not safe to go yet." He insists, "No, I'm going to go," with his suit and his hat on and looking like an elderly gentleman putting a note in the wall, because the kavod is important and the other guy stole his glory. So yeah, these things matter. They shouldn't matter, but they do, because we live in a world of people, not of abstract ideas. All right, we'll stop here. Next time, we'll discuss the hamtana, the period of the waiting time.